Welcome again to all of you and to our TV audience. Our guest today is Andrew Nikiforuk, who is the author of Bird Flu, Mad Cow Disease, and Other Biological Plagues of the 21st Century. I'm sure there are a lot of questions that you people have. If you have a preamble, please keep it short. You can use the microphone over there, or you can come up to the microphone here. And I must say, Andrew, your solution to ask my doctor to wipe his stethoscope with alcohol, I'm a little worried about that. He'll say, Ed, you'll do anything to get a drink. Who has a question?
Hello, my name is Jean Fennell.
Hi, Jean.
I would really like your input on airplane travel. We do a lot of it, and of course you can only breathe the air that is in
transatlantic flights. I'm sure there's lots of bad air. What can we do to prevent getting germs?
That is a good question, Jean, and I'm not sure if I have a good answer for that. It's just one indication of the kind of the volume of airline traffic that's taking place around the world, and what airlines can take with them is that if you go to any airport in Europe, you'll find that locally they have a problem with malaria. And these are all mosquitoes that have been introduced from other regions of the world and have created small pockets of malaria around these airports. So probably it's not so much what you have to worry about in the plane, although a plane is a very, because you're in a closed quarters and you're breathing recycled air, you're breathing everything that everyone else is breathing. Which is why if you have one person on a plane with influenza, 70% of them can end up being infected by the end of the flight. Your best defense always is don't travel unless you are in good health. You know, if you are sick, stay home. And so don't travel if you're not feeling well. And because you'll probably not only will you be carrying something someone else doesn't want, but you might pick up something you don't want along the way as well. So really, I mean, the best defense against so many things about so many biological invasions, and the same applies when you're going to the hospital, and of course, quite often you can't control that one, but, you know, don't go into a hospital unless you really need to go in there. And certainly look at other alternatives that you might explore before that, but take care of your health.
Thanks for coming, Andrew. I've got a question. My name is James Moore. I've been watching, I don't watch television much at all, but when I do watch it once in a while, I hear these commercials, and they're always busy with these, what they call antibacterials, and they're spraying things, and they always say something like, it kills 99.9%. And my concern is, when I see that, I'm thinking, okay, so what about that 0.1% that they're training to resist all of this stuff? And I'm thinking that perhaps they should be called probacterials rather than anti. Could you just comment on that, please?
That's a really good question. And you're absolutely right. The more we, if we succumb to fear and start going to the store and buying all these antibacterial sprays and what we are really doing is contributing to bacterial evolution in an unfortunate way. We are just making those microbes more hardy and more virulent and more resistant. And all we really need to do, and I mean, is we don't need to nuke our hands with all sorts of antibacterial things, we just need to wash them with ordinary soap. That is still the best defense and will always be the best defense. But if half the population starts using, you know, all kinds of special formulas and chemical treatments, then what we are doing is we are encouraging the bacteria to up the ante and say, look, you're going to throw that stuff at us, we're going to throw this back at you. And, you know, it's much like a gang fight. You know, somebody starts out with knives, they say, well, if you've got knives, we're going to get guns. And they say, well, if you've got guns, we're going to get automatic weapons, and if you've got automatic weapons, heck, we're going to get an army, and then before, you know, and nobody wins. And in this case, the bacteria will come out. I mean, they're always there, and they've got nothing to lose. We will be the losers. So I'm quite often dismayed at the commercial attention that is paid to a lot of this stuff. It's because a lot of it is bogus, and you're really supporting the bacterial armies and invaders out there rather than neutralizing them. You want to neutralize them, just wash with ordinary soap. And it's the same. It's really interesting that Paul Ewald, who's an American evolutionary ecologist, looked at bacteria in water, and he said, okay, what do we need to do to make cholera really, really dangerous and really, really nasty? Well, what cholera needs is really dirty water to evolve and reach that point where it becomes extremely virulent and extremely nasty. Not just cholera, but most organisms that travel in water, bacterial organisms that will affect us, whether it's E. coli or anything else. What he found, though, is that if the cleaner the water got, the more benign the bacteria got. So there we had a simple experiment that showed quite clearly that our behaviors could influence the evolution of a biological invader from a highly malignant state by creating lots of sewage and open waste and throwing all kinds of crap in our water supply to a situation where we're really careful and where we treat our watersheds with respect and where we keep our water systems clean. And if we do that, then we don't find the same level of virulent organisms in them anywhere. And in a simple matter there, that's a great prevention thing we can do. But we're very reluctant to do that as a species. We want to be able to somehow, now we're going to muck up our water supply, and then heck, we're going to create some kind of biological monstrous invader, and then we're going to complain about it when it comes back and bites us on the ass and kills a whole bunch of people, forgetting that, hey guys, you know, we didn't pay attention to the basics. But that's a classic example of how we can help the evolution of biological invaders by doing bad things. And we can reverse evolution in many ways and turn these global citizens, they are truly the only global citizens, into pretty benign citizens by behaving differently.
Hello. I think I should have worn my high heels. My name is Barbara Warren, and in your talk you said that we should ask our doctors to give us their infection rate. Now, my husband had prostate cancer, and we couldn't find a doctor anywhere in Canada that kept the rate of his success of treating cancer with statistics. So do you think he's going to tell me his infection rate?
That's a really good question, and and what you're really talking about is carelessness in the professions, and this is one of the reasons we don't hear a lot about biological invasions in our hospitals, because that would mean that a lot of very well-educated people are doing things that they really shouldn't be doing. And that's why we need the transparency, and that's why we need to begin to ask these questions. And we need to do it in a way that hopefully the profession will respond with some dignity and some accountability and say, and I've talked to a lot of infection control people recently in the last year, and they've said, you know, it's a huge problem, Andrew. Yeah, we're reluctant to admit it. we don't want to be condemned for it. It's not just our problem. And I said, you know, that's right, you're just part of the equation here. But you guys need to come clean on this. And I think it's a matter of again, and I'm always stunned sometimes by the passivity of Canadians versus other cultures, that when you're presented with a real problem that a professional group actually has some control over, that we're really reluctant to muck in there and say, you know, clean up your act, for God's sake. You guys know better. You've done the research. There are infection control people in Canada who've written stunning opinions and articles in the Journal of Hospital Infections asking why their peers aren't doing the right thing. But they're not going to do the right thing unless we as citizens begin to ask those questions. And you have every right to ask those questions. They are uncomfortable questions. They need to be asked. And a good surgeon will tell you, you know, I lose a couple, and I have lost a couple to MRSA or C. diff, whatever. And hospitals need to report that, and they need to track that. And I, as a citizen, should have the right to go to a hospital that pays more attention to cleanliness if I want to and has a low infection rate than one that has got, you know, a 10 to 20% infection rate. Or I should have that choice to send my parents there or my grandparents there. So you're raising that this is a whole issue of professional control of medicine, and in many ways we've sort of let them take over, and citizens need to get in there and be part of that. And what I found really phenomenal, really interesting, is you go back and you look at all the stories about, you know, hospitals originally were set up for in the 12th and 13th centuries, they were set up as places for people to die. There were no places for the sick, really. A hospital was a place of solace where you would go and you would spend your last days there, usually with clergy, with nuns or with priests, and you would think about your life and your relationship to God, and that's what a hospital was. It was a place full of solace. It wasn't necessarily a comfortable place, but it was a place full of solace. And then it became a place where we dealt with the sick. And what's interesting, in the Middle East, their hospitals are a little bit different than ours. They were very aware of infection control and the importance of infection and control. And before they even built a hospital, they would stick a piece of rotten meat in the area where they wanted to build the hospital, and if the meat putrefied within a day or two, they knew this was a bad location for the hospital. Stunning. And that was 600 years ago. We don't even do that today, right? So we had these different models for hospitals. By the 19th century, they had definitely become places where professionals were looking after the sick and the wounded. And the problems then with hospital infection were phenomenal. I mean, you're losing 20 to 30% of your patients on a regular basis. And that's why you had people like Florence Nightingale come to the fore and say, hey, why aren't we keeping records of this? Why aren't we measuring what we're doing in our success rate? And that's still a dangerous question to ask the medical profession today. But one of the most phenomenal guys was Ignaz Semmelweis, who was an obstetrician. And in those days, you had separate hospitals for pregnant women. And they weren't even called hospitals, but they were, I forget the name that they had for them, but they were separate. They weren't there with all the other, you weren't there with a whole bunch of infectious, sick, or dying people. But quite often the doctors that would work in these hospitals would be working on cadavers for a couple of hours before they come to the hospital and help these women deliver their children. And in those places where male doctors did that, they had these like phenomenal death rates. Again, we're looking at 30-40% death rate. Meanwhile, the midwives had infection rates of around 5% or lower. And so Semmelweis looked at this, and he looked at this data, and he said, boy, that's, you know, what's the difference here? And then he looked at the difference, and he said, you know, interesting thing about midwives, they don't go poking around in cadavers before they deliver a child. Whereas all these male doctors thought this was perfectly, you know, acceptable thing to do. Well, Samuel Weiss pointed this out. He instituted a bunch of very simple hygiene protocols in his hospital. He brought down the death rate down to 5 or 6%. Phenomenal success. But his profession was totally pissed off at him for having had the gall to point out to these very privileged, very well-educated men that somehow they weren't washing their hands thoroughly enough. And he was vilified by his profession, and he ended up in an insane asylum where he was stabbed by another patient and died, believe it or not, of a hospital-acquired infection. I tell that story because we are still dealing with the same bloody issues in this century as we were last century.
My question deals with water quality, and there's a variety of standards for water quality. It's my understanding that the more things you want to filter out to make the water pure, the more expensive it is. And I'm just wondering whether you have raised that issue in your book and whether that's of concern to you. If we're using antibiotics and they're not being taken from the drinking water to purify it, are we not making ourselves sitting ducks just by drinking water?
What's over here? sitting ducks. there is so much in our water supply right now that it's quite frightening. And and certainly the more antibiotics and the more drugs we take, we know that more and more of that stuff is ending up in our water. And we don't know what the end result of that will be. Well, we can pretty well guess that what we're going to do is we're going to create some rather phenomenal invaders with some phenomenal properties of resistance to all kinds of drugs. And we tend to focus on the fact that we want to purify everything coming out of the tap, when in fact we should really concentrate on the source of our water and keeping that all clean and unadulterated in the first place. And let me, for a moment, rather here trying to sell you what I think is a really phenomenal book called Pandemonium, put on another hat as a landowner in southern Alberta and as a member of the Livingston Landowners Group, saying, you know, we have concerns about the eastern slopes. That is Lethbridge's watershed. That is Medicine Hat's watershed. That is the watershed that provides water for Saskatoon. Yet we're faced with a phenomenal rate of development, unplanned development, that will include uranium mining in the Porcupine Hills, 5,000 to 10,000 oil and gas wells between Turner Valley and Highway 3, a doubling of existing roads, a doubling of the existing population, all by 2050. The landscape in the eastern slopes will change dramatically. And with those changes, the watershed will be gone. You add climate change on top of that, and southern Alberta is looking at a very, very serious problem. So, wearing my hat as a landowner today, if you could just take the message to everyone that you know or who enjoys drinking water here in Lethbridge, that the source of their drinking water is currently imperiled by the lack of a plan for the eastern slopes, I would greatly appreciate that. And I'd love to come back and talk to you about that whole issue and battle another time.
My name is Beverly Gallatly, and I'm a retired public health nurse, and I found your talk extremely interesting, and thank you very much. I have two questions. One, if you could just elucidate for us just how Scandinavia is doing this in their hospitals. And secondly, would you mind telling us if you have any information how our seniors' residences are faring, those people who eat together? Thank you very much.
The Scandinavians took a radically different point of view about biological invaders in hospitals in the 1970s and the 1980s. And I can't really tell you why, but there are probably good cultural reasons why, but I can't explain why. In contrast, the United Kingdom and the United States said, okay, well, we're just going to have to live with this stuff, and we're not going to worry about it. Scandinavians said, no, we don't think we have to live with this. This is a problem, and this will affect our performance, and this will affect people, the credibility of the hospital and of our profession, and a whole bunch of people are going to die if we don't do something about it, unnecessarily. So they decided to tackle the issue square on right away. And they decided, okay, well, we need to have more isolation wards. So if somebody comes in and they do have this infection, or if they acquire it, we isolate them so it doesn't spread. Number two, we can't, just because we have antibiotics, we can't give up our cleaning protocols and our hand hygiene. The antibiotics, they're not going to, you know, we have to be vigilant in other areas. And we have to use our antibiotics more judiciously than we are. They are precious resources. But if we overuse them, then we're going to create these biological monsters. Then they also set up protocols for testing their own staff. So that if a surgeon or a physician who regularly visited patients had been colonized by MRSA, which is very common, and was carrying the bug, then they would be off for 9 months until the bug had cleared from their system. And they wouldn't be allowed back into the hospital until it was gone. Because they found that if you have one physician or one surgeon in the hospital has been colonized, and they have a really heavy patient load, they're taking this stuff all over the place. You know, even a doctor with something as simple as a tie can, and bending over, and the tie touches the patient, can be spreading MRSA. This thing is like unbelievable. It is hell on wheels. It can be in a keyboard of a computer. So people entering in statistics and stuff come, bing, pack it, pick up the bug, and if they don't wash their hands before they see the next person or shake somebody's hands, it's spreading. So the Scandinavians set up these very systematic protocols that dealt with, you know, we'll isolate the patient, where we will do proper surveillance on this bug to make sure that we know where it's at and where it's at in the hospital and what wards appear to have higher rates of MRSA infection. And you'll always find it in your intensive care and your burn ward. Those are the two key areas where you're going to find them. What do we do about those wards? What can we do differently there to cut down the infection? What kind of procedures are associated with a high degree of infection? Well, catheters in particular. Okay, well, then maybe we have to do something different about catheters and not use them as often and so on. So the Scandinavians did all of those things. They brought their rates down from 10% to around 1%, and that's where they have stayed, an average of 1%. They still have to deal with the fact now that patients, because they're traveling around the world, or people who become patients have traveled around the world, are bringing MRSA into the hospitals and into the community. And that is still, that is becoming an enormous problem for them. But their hospitals aren't as dangerous as the hospitals in England or the hospitals in the United States or the hospitals in Canada. And that was all because people decided to do something rather than accept something. A simple behavioral change. We are responsible for making our hospitals safe places. A patient shouldn't come into a hospital and acquire an infection there. Not if we can help it. So different attitudes, different protocols, and different way to use resources. They decided if we prevent this stuff, we can save money. Well, in the United Kingdom and the United States, they've not prevented it, and they've spent billions trying to control it. And it's been a total disaster in England. Every day in the press in England, there's a horror story about a mother who's lost a child to MRSA or a parent who's lost a grandparent to MRSA almost on a daily basis.
Okay, well, where do we find these? Probably hospital-acquired infection
term, because it doesn't include nursing homes, for example. Nursing homes have a phenomenal high rate of infections. They're being invaded on a regular basis, not just by MRSA, but C. difficile, by Norwalk virus or norovirus, and these agents will come into a nursing home, they'll take out 10% of the people there, and they're gone. And comes down to the same issues again. It comes down to proper hygiene. It comes down to overcrowding. It comes down to the fact that that we have in North America a dismissive view of what happens to older people. You know, if these were children dying in nursing homes, we might be perhaps a little more responsive, but we're not. Same thing in Montreal. I mean, it was well known among the doctors there. The reason this problem was allowed to go on because people thought, oh shit, it's only affecting people in their 70s and their 80s. You know, an appalling attitude. But nursing homes, again, are quite often, we have this problem with monoculture. We have a cultural problem in the sense we have children who don't want to care for their parents at home. And then we have these monocultures where there are many elderly patients. Some of them are extremely unwell. Many of them are immunocompromised. And quite often the standard of care is not good.
Campbell, and my question to you is, I don't know if it evolves around a conspiracy theory or not, but I have read in several publications about especially the supposedly coming bird flu, that this was really put out into the media and we got so much notice about it and what was going to happen and everything, and it was just kind of a ploy perhaps on the Americans' part and especially the George Bush government to take away the rating of the people not being happy with the war and things, and that this still may be what it is. And also in these publications it said the best way to arm yourself against any kind of flu would be to build up your immune system and just to do what you would do for a 3-month supply of food or whatever it is, medications, and think that you would just on a natural basis rather than creating such a panic around it. And I'm just wondering if you have heard anything in this regard?
Question. I start the book out. The first chapter in the book is all about bird flu. And that was a question I had to deal with at the time. I thought, well, how serious is this, and where is this thing going to go? And you could see at a certain point that the media and everybody was onto it and thinking, okay, well, this is, you know, this could really explode and we'll have a hell of a problem on our hands. And for reasons I don't think anyone can explain, it has not exploded into the human population. Okay, but let's look at some of the other damage it has done. This is a biological invasion that started in factory farms in southern China about 5 to 8 years ago. There are 154 influenza viruses, and they're constantly recombining and doing all sorts of stuff. This one exploded, and it exploded in factory farms because you have a lot of immunocompromised chickens there, who have been bred essentially to be meat bearers, have virtually no disease resistance. They're all genetically uniform. Just a perfect situation for growing a virus. So this virus escaped from these farms, and with via the poultry trade and also the poultry vaccine trade, spread throughout Asia and created essentially an economic disaster for small chicken farmers because this virus heated up and was killing chickens of every kind, even the really disease-hardy chickens that the average peasant raised in their backyard in a scale of 20 to 30 chickens. So you had the factory farm business creating a new, not a new virus, but a really virulent virus that could burn up a chicken pretty quickly, that it changed the whole poultry trade in Asia. And to this day, I mean, the consequences about it are absolutely phenomenal in terms of providing protein for people. Meanwhile, we had a whole bunch of virologists and public health guys thinking, oh my God, what if this thing gets out and, you know, and jumps from birds into people? And you know, 1918-1919 Spanish flu was a global calamity. Let's put it in perspective. I mean, it killed less than 1% of the world's population. even so, that was close to 50 million people at the time. We're not even quite sure about the numbers because when it ripped through in India and Africa, we weren't counting the dead. But we were counting the dead in North America, and almost every family at the time could have a story about the flu, about either the relatives that got really sick or the relatives that died. So everyone thought, okay, well, what if that happens again? Well, it could happen again. And we had the same predictions made in 1968 with the swine flu. It's like, oh, geez, what if this breaks out and we, you know, have the same 1919 all over? And this one certainly got really carried away. And I would agree with this guy who says, yes, you know, your best defense is, you know, stay well, you know, eat well, don't travel too much, stay out of hospitals, crowded airplanes, all that sort of stuff, you know, common sense stuff, okay? You don't need to load yourself up with vaccines and antiviral drugs and all that sort of crap. I mean, it became a marketing craze and a marketing sensation, but, you know, the companies did what you'd expect them to do. So now we have a whole stockpile of viral vaccines and no pandemic. That's all true. I don't think H5N1 is going to break out. I don't think it's going to, you know, give us a lot of trouble. But the conditions that created that virus are still there. The combination of the poultry trade and the growth of mega cities in Asia, and the fouling of water, and water is a good way to transport this virus, and the fact that the biological diversity in the region is being hammered. So your natural disease filter, wild fowl, wild chickens, wild birds, I mean, they were absolutely hammered by this, with huge mortalities. That filter is becoming smaller and smaller. And we have more and more monocultures that are becoming more and more vulnerable. So will we have a pandemic at some point that might be due to influenza of some variety, springing out of Asia or springing out of a factory farm in Europe or India or God knows where? I think it's likely the event will happen. Will it be mild or severe? Who the hell knows? Will it be an economic saboteur? In all likelihood, it probably will. Will it be a great human killer? We don't know. But it's just one of those many biological bombs out there. This one certainly introduced a huge degree of menace to everyday life, but it was a false alarm. In many ways, quite the same way SARS was. And you realize, though, that what each one of these does is that they habituate us to the prospect that biological insecurity is going to become a way of life. And at the same time, they're driving us to measures of biological security that are illusions. I mean, it's like this, let's lather up with the most antiviral, antibacterial stuff we can. And none of our responses are what they should be, which is, okay, we need to live more locally. Maybe people in Europe shouldn't be eating chickens grown in Thailand. Maybe that's a really stupid idea. You know, so.
Thank you for your presentation. Indeed, I remember other times you've been here, and it's always been a stimulating discussion, and so I hope to come back again. I'm tempted to ask whether you've got any Christmas cards lately from hospital administrators or doctors, but that's not my question.
Well, you can tell I won't have any Christmas cards this year.
No, I can see that it'll be easy on the mail system. But I was intrigued by your thought that hospitals should have be more public and transparent about their infection rates and so on. I'm intrigued by it. I think it's a steep hill to climb in that we haven't got this notion about being in partnership with the medical profession or the hospital program, and I think hospitals tend to be very private places in the way that IBM and Microsoft is with their information. And it's and I suspect the movement to private boards, appointed boards, as opposed to publicly elected hospital boards, is probably a movement away from accountability. I wonder if you have any comment on that and any suggestions about where this conversation would begin besides buying your book and at least knowing the right acronyms for these infections.
I think you've made a lot of good points. You know, there was a C. difficile outbreak in Calgary in 2000 that affected well over 1,000 patients. I don't remember reading a damn thing about it in the Calgary Herald. And the MRSA outbreak that we now have in the city, and that's putting 30 to 40, and this is community acquired, we're seeing 30 to 40 people a month in the hospitals with these infections. And these are really aggressive infections that require extreme care and antibiotic treatment, usually on an intravenous. Again, there's virtually little being said about this. But I think just as ordinary citizens, we need to engage our local physicians, our family physicians, and say, okay, what about this? We need to encourage more debate about the use of antibiotics, as well as the design and state of our hospitals. I mean, the new Children's Hospital in Calgary, but actually only has about, I think, two or three more beds than the original Children's Hospital. You know, what can we say? Ralph said that we don't plan in this province. But it has, the hospital has many design features about it that, to me, are troubling. I mean, the place looks like a mall and has a huge open-air place where for public performances and stuff, and why I think, well, that's a novel idea. I've never heard of a hospital before where you would actually have public performances. Again, somebody wasn't really thinking about any of these issues when they designed that hospital. And let's have a separate building for our public performances and so on, but let's not do it in the middle of a hospital, guys. It's just not very sound. But I think what we need in this province, and we need a return to elected boards. We need some more accountability there. You're right about hospitals sort of thinking about themselves as being sort of separate, almost corporate identities that don't have a community face. We need to change that because it's the community that comes to the hospital, and it's the hospital that needs to be more accountable to the community. And if we need more accountability on both sides. I mean, we're going to hospitals expecting them to do a lot of damn things they shouldn't be doing in many cases, and they're trying to accommodate our consumer attitude towards health, which is, you know, if something's wrong, you got to fix it, you got to do it for me right away, bang, 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 give me the drugs and no questions asked. And we need to both engage the community and the healthcare profession to start talking, having a different dialogue about things. And with a greater emphasis on prevention, a greater emphasis on public health and keeping the public health first and foremost in our minds.
Just a supplementary question that occurs to me as you were answering. You're talking about a lot of
material, reportable items, and any comments on why it's not being reported? Do the media not understand the issues? Is there some kind of pact of silence, or any comments?
Well, you're asking a question about my trade, and a question about the accountability of my trade and the state of my trade, and we have a problem there, and it's a big one. We have most newspapers have abandoned the beat system, so we no longer have reporters who are on a beat who are covering something for any length of time. So they never have the chance to acquire any degree of expertise or contacts that allows them to actually come to some conclusions about things. So that has been a disaster in journalism in this country. We also have, the newspapers do not appear to me to be as civic-minded as they once were, that they're more interested in serving you up news about Angelina Jolie, as pretty as she is, and Brad Pitt, as handsome as he is, but that's not going to solve my problem with overcrowding in my hospitals, or overcrowding in my schools, or a city that's just out of control. Not to mention an overheated economy and a government that doesn't believe in planning. So I make no excuses for my trade. It is in a bad shape these days. And so this is why you don't find a lot of these issues in the newspaper where they belong or on the TV where they belong. We have shorter attention spans. If anything requires a high degree of research and time, or there isn't the money and the resources to support that kind of endeavor. So that's why you have to buy my book. So,
well, thank you very much, Andrew, for accepting my invitation to come down. I think, as usual, you've given a very provocative talk and raised a lot of issues. Next week, our speaker will be Dr. Lal Olberg, one of the contenders for the leadership. We hope you'll be here next week. Thank you for coming, and he has his book for sale outside. You can find more about Mad Cow, which he didn't mention, and a few other things. Thank you.